such enthusiastic energy here on this Sunday morning. You want me to use the microphone?
We're getting an audio recording.
Oh, we're getting, I'm stuck. All right. Okay, all right, let me shove this aside then. What? Ah. I move around a lot, okay? Is that all right? I told Sam this is not a speech. This is a, theatrical performance. So, okay. All right, good. I have written down some notes, though, so I don't get too far afield, and I know I only have like 40 minutes, so it's going to come quickly, so put your ears on, and let's run through as much of this as possible. I think everybody here is very well aware of the context of where we are, that the average American farmer is almost 60 years old, roughly 50% of America's farmland will change hands in the next 15 years. The question is that land going to be gobbled up by foreign interests, corporate interests, global interests, large interests, and continue down the path of soil erosion, depredation, aesthetically, aromatically, pillaging destructive farms, and nutrient-deficient food, or is it going to be snarfed up by a new generation of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, entrepreneurial womb caressers who love our land, our food, and actually love their customers and don't see them as enemies or impudent peasants to be exploited? So that is the question. How do we make that transition? I like to explain to my urban friends who don't understand the context of where we are that when my mom and dad bought our farm in 1961, it was 550 acres in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. They bought it for $90 an acre in 1961, $90 an acre. Today, that farm is worth about $8,000 an acre. In 1961, our feeder calf sale, when we sold calves, 500-pound calves, were selling for about $30 a hundredweight. Okay, that's, if you remember the $90, 30 to 90, that's a 1-to-3, are you with me, 1-to-3 ratio? Today, those calves, wow, they've gone way up to $1.50 a hundredweight. So they've increased fivefold while the land has increased 85-fold. That is why Grandpa's farm will not work today. And that is why we are seeing one of the reasons we're seeing a lot of financial pressure. Now, we could either say, well, that's because it's a fundamental land problem. We could also say it's a fundamental food appreciation problem. And I would suggest that it's a little bit of both. One of the problems is that we see our land as a commodity, and one of the problems is that while we have unions to protect workers and all sorts of regulations to protect this and that and everything else in the marketplace, the only orthodoxy of our culture is cheaper food by the day. And that creates a ratio that is constantly out of whack. The fact is that when young people can't get in, old people can't get out. And so we have both generations stuck. One is excluded and unhappily, and one is included unhappily. And so having fluidity between the generations is absolutely critical and what this symposium is all about. One of the things that I want to bring up, and I wouldn't be true to my Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic self if I didn't bring it up here today, is the role of food safety and regulatory zoning, requirements over the ability of young people to get into farming. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to do some charcuterie in your kitchen and sell it to a neighbor, you could get a 5-gallon bucket and an old refrigerator and some salt and pepper, and you could make some charcuterie and sell it to the neighbor. Today, in order to do that, you have to be zoned for a business. You have to have a HACCP plan approved by government bureaucrats. You have to have OSHA-approved working situations. You have to have licenses for this, that, and the other. A fire extinguisher, a commercial kitchen, a licensed kitchen. I mean, you can't be in a residential zone. I mean, we wouldn't want to work where we live, would we? I mean. And so ultimately what we've done is we have segregated our food system. We have segregated our economic sectors. We have segregated every facet of life so that a non-integrated approach makes it very difficult to enter. And, one of the reasons that our bacon is $15 a pound is not because it costs that much to make it or do it. It's because for an artisanal, small-scale entity to jump through an industrial set of regulatory structures, that's what it costs to send it up and down the interstate as many times as it has to be sent up and down to go to a compliant, large-scale, approved facility in order to take a pig born and raised on our farm and sell it to our neighbor. It's unconscionable and immoral that our country has so locked out entrepreneurial, innovation, embryonic entities from commerce with their neighbors with something as intimate and righteous as food choice. And that's one of the reasons I'm a member of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, because they are carving out some freedoms for us in this sector. We believe that a person should be able to acquire the food of their choice from the source of their choice without a bureaucrat getting in between to license it. So, am I switching from
the land rant?
Yeah, I will. But you can't separate the land problem from the regulatory problem. You see, the reason that our farm became famous and was able to be successful was the pastured poultry PL 9042 processing exemption that allowed us to start with 5 chickens in the backyard selling them to a neighbor, which you can't do with beef, pork, charcuterie, pot pies, or meringue. Are you with me? And the result is that the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed entrepreneurial opportunities that would provide low-capital, small-scale, artisanship, entry-level business opportunities are thwarted by a labyrinthine, Byzantine, Neanderthal system of orthodoxy that says we need to have sterile food, stable food, transportable food, not living food. And so suddenly, 10-10-10 grown tomatoes are legal, but compost grown tomatoes aren't. Vis-a-vis the current Food Safety Modernization Act that's currently written, will criminalize compost use in the garden. We can't have compost. That's dirty. There's sex going on in a compost pile. We can't have that. Okay. So the point is that we have to preserve embryonic, innovative entrepreneurship. The result of all this is not just the denial of young people to be able to get in with their entrepreneurial activities. It is a denial to our culture of innovative antidotes to the E. coli, Campylobacter, Salmonella, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, pollution, and problems of our industrial food system. So ultimately, our culture denies itself its own innovative antidotes by codifying an orthodoxy of industrialization in our food system. All right, now I've got several ideas here. Watch my time. I don't have a clock on the wall, so I'm going to be watching my clock. Sorry. All right. I've got several ideas here to run by you that are just kind of contextual here. First of all, I don't believe there's a farm in the world, including ours, that is fully developed. And when I say developed, I don't mean apartments, condominiums, and asphalt. I mean leveraging the synergistic, awesome complexities of the air, soil, and water, and multi-speciation on a place. The problem is that farm kids grow up coveting their neighbor's land. And I think this being Sunday morning, it's okay to talk about coveting your neighbor's land. That is not a healthy thing. The average farm kid grows up who wants to continue on the farm, and they're only thinking about how do we expand the beef cattle or the wheat farm or the cherry orchard, and thinking about expanding the current production horizontally, that takes more acreage. And what we've done on our farm is the permaculture concept of stacking, where you take pasture and you grow cows, you run eggmobiles behind the cows, you run pastured broilers on the same field, pastured turkeys on the same field, and suddenly you're generating $10,000 an acre instead of the average in our county of $250 an acre, stacking complementary economic enterprises on that land. Now, when you start talking like that to the average farmer, who is almost 60 years old today, the average farmer sinks into the chair, puts his head in his hands, and says, "But I'm tired." Okay? I'm tired. So my message to the old folks and who tend to be hermit curmudgeon farmers is, I'm not asking you to develop your farm anymore. Your productive, your innovative and you know, high failure rate days are over. Okay? What I plead with you to do is to embrace a young partner. That doesn't mean that it jeopardizes your mothership. You're raising beef cattle. There's not a beef cattle operation in the world that can't stand a pastured poultry operation on the same land base that simply grows more grass for the cows. This is land development, you see. This is land development. There's not a farm anywhere that's an orchard or a grain farm or a grass farm that can't do with some ponds for hydration and resiliency and forgiveness in the landscape when droughts come, and we all know about those. And that person putting in the ponds might grow some freshwater prawns or catfish or whatever, or do recreational bass fishing in those ponds and build a center of riparian schools for kids to come out and romp on them. That business, whether it's agritourism, production, whatever, can be built on an existing land base that is complementary, not competitive, to the existing mothership. And that then creates farms that are fully developed. Back when I was first wanting to come back to the farm as a teen, Dad and I sat down. We took our little farm. We have 100 acres open and 550 in woodland. And we said, let's do a brainstorming session and just figure out and see how many white-collar salaries could be produced from this little farm, realizing that in our area, it takes, on average, over 600 acres of open land to produce one salary. And that's, of course, assuming the spouse works in town, so you get health insurance. And so we did that. And this was like 40 years ago we did this, and we came up with 25 white-collar salaries from our little farm. We haven't even begun to develop that yet. We haven't scratched the surface on what could be done. Now, when you start having 25 salaries on an existing farm, well, then suddenly a lot of those opportunities are not necessarily direct production. You need somebody to answer the phone. So one person could be a full-time nanny, babysitter, so families could leave and go on a vacation or go to town to get something to eat for their anniversary or whatever, you know, and take some pressure off of the farm. You can't get away, you know, kind of thing. That's the thing about a farm. Especially if you have animals. A full-time mechanic, you know, somebody that keeps everybody's cars running, or a full-time shop foreman, you know, a welder and acetylene torch operator, maybe a woodworker that fixes everybody's furniture in their houses. Are you with me? We're talking about building a synergistic, complex, relational community that biomimics the kind of diversity we see in ecological systems. Okay? All right. That's number two. Okay. I've come to the conclusion that no farm is sustainable unless it produces two salaries. Now, why is that? Why is that? It's the cycle of life, okay? I'm almost 60. Wes is a little bit ahead of me, just a little. But you're looking good, Wes. You know, you know how you know when you're getting older? When people say you're looking good instead of good looking. All right. Do you know that my wife is his fourth cousin? We didn't know that. He was doing a bunch of ancestry stuff, and he came out to Augusta County and found the common grave. Talk about the commons, you know, the common grave tree. My wife's, our great-great something or other, and you're probably just, hers great-great-great, and you're just great, you know. So anyway, here's the point. In order to have multi-generational fluidity, we've got to have farms that generate two salaries, okay? So we've got to be thinking about two salaries. If you're a young person going in, I want you to think as quickly as possible about how can I bring on another salary here. If you're an elder person, you know, in your late 40s and you're yeah, I mean, you know, you got to start thinking about these things early. You know, you're not the same guy or gal at 60 that you are at 20, you know, when you're invincible. And you start, you know, now when I jump off the tractor, I don't just jump from the seat to the ground. I actually look for the little step, you know, and step down so I don't wrench a knee or whatever, right? I mean, this is the cycle of life. And so we need to generate two salaries. Number three is we need to divorce the, and listen to this. This is going to be revolutionary for you. We need to divorce the farm from the land. What? What's the difference between a farm and a wilderness area? The difference is what a farmer has done to the land. The land is the same. Same stream running through it, same species, same climate, same rainfall, probably the same, you know, old roads or paths that were, you know, run through the place. The difference between a farm and any other kind of land thing is what a farmer has done to it. And that's one of my big problems with land preservation efforts, if I may go where angels fear to tread, is that it is too devoted to maintaining farmland and not farmers. And you can't maintain farmland without maintaining farmers. And I appreciate what's happening here is addressing the complexities of the farmer situation. That's a good thing. But what this means is when I say divorce the land from the farm, what I'm talking about is the infrastructure and the equipment that runs the farm. So on our farm, if you came and visited us, what you would see is almost no stationary infrastructure. All the infrastructure, the gobbledygos, the egg mobiles, the chicken shelters, the cattle shade mobiles, the duck shelters, the lamb shelters, everything is portable. And today, with our modern technology, bandsaw mills, nursery shade cloth and lightweight infrastructure, we can tinker toy together portable infrastructure that our ancestors couldn't do when they were building log cabins and mass and post and beam construction and thinking about building things that would last for 200 years. Let's just cobble together something that composts in 10 years, because by that time we're probably going to innovate something new. It'll be obsolete, and this doesn't lock us into infrastructure and enslave us. See, the problem with high cost, high capital, stationary infrastructure is that it enslaves all the decision making into the foreseeable future to that infrastructure. You know, what do you do when a young person goes to some grass conference and comes home all excited about, you know, they got a running a confinement dairy operation, right? And they come home and they're all excited. You know, grandpa comes out of the shed, you know, and the son or daughter says, "Hey, grandpa, guess what? I went to this conference. You know, we could turn the cows out. We wouldn't have to make silage, fill the silos, scrape that concrete thing, have, you know, hip dysplasia in the cows all the time. I mean, we could turn the cows out on grass. They could harvest it, poop right there. That grows more grass. We don't have to haul any poop anywhere." And, you know, and they're all excited. And all of a sudden, grandpa goes, "What? Don't you know I spent a whole lifetime pouring concrete, bending rebar,
building this stuff, trying to remortgage a farm and put in this in these buildings. And you're just gonna walk away from it? Whose child are you? That's the way it goes, right? Because our toys define our decision making. We invest so much money and emotional, mental, spiritual energy into our infrastructure that we think it frees us up, but it actually ties us up in our creativity for the next generation. Another part that's portable in this, not only infrastructure, but our customers. See, customers will move with you too, wherever you go. That's cool. Which means, bring me to four, which means that the equity in our farm needs to be in management and information rather than infrastructure. And when we divorce the infrastructure from the land, we have a portable farm. We don't have to own the land anymore. Now suddenly we can farm anywhere. We lose the lease. We just move the farm off. We've done this. We now lease 9 properties. And we've walked away from a couple of them when landlords get just intolerable to deal with. And we just go over with a couple flatbed trailers. We load a whole $100,000 farm up on a couple flatbed trailers and move the place off kit and caboodle. We rip up everything, pull up the water line, and they don't even know we've been there. And we've saved all of our capital investment, which allows us to put it anywhere. I call this nook and cranny farming. Think about all the little 2-acre, 3-acre, 5-acre nooks and crannies. You can run pigs there. You can grow vegetables there. You can do all sorts of, because your rake and your hoe and your shovel, you know, it all just goes with you. I mean, look at what Jean Fortier has done in Quebec, you know, with the $100,000 1.5-acre farm. And it's all portable. So when we divorce the farm from the land, it completely opens up a lot of opportunities, which puts us into the equity is in management and information, which is, I would suggest, the newest and best kind of farm. Back several years ago when energy costs really went up, we got concerned, and so we did an audit. And I read in an ag bulletin that the average farmer, 50% of their expenses is on petroleum, on fuel. And I said, boy, you know, let's see where we are on this, you know, continuum. Are we above it or after it or whatever? Remember, we're running a full, you know, distribution, a delivery service into the urban sector with 2 delivery trucks, you know. So we've got fuel costs. Anyway. So we ran all of our numbers, and guess what? Our fuel costs were only 5%. Okay? 5%. And we concluded that diesel could go to $10 a gallon and we'd still be fine. Now, we don't like expensive energy any more than anybody else, but it was very comforting to know that at least we'd be the last guy standing. And you hope that by the time you're the last guy standing, somebody has innovated a solution. Equity does not have to be borrowed from a bank. Equity in management and information. You don't have to borrow that from a bank. That's what's cool about this. Which is why we want to have information-dense kind of farming, which means multi-speciation. One of the reasons people don't like to do our kind of multi-speciated farming, diversified farming, is because you got to know so much about so many things. You got to know not only how to load a cow, but how to load a pig. You got to know how to plant a warm season vegetable and a cool season vegetable. And that takes a lot of information. It's a lot easier to just buy the chemicals and put one crop in. That's a very simplified farming. But when we start putting our farming into the equity of management and information, it creates firewalls of protection for what we're doing. All right, 5. Physical retail interfaces are cumbersome. Physical retail interfaces are cumbersome. All of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with eBay, Craigslist, all sorts of e-commerce. I mean, Amazon.com, there are, I mean, I'm not, because I don't know even how to hardly can turn on a computer. But a lot of people are into electronic commerce, okay? And this is providing a pathway in for
for local artisanal integrity food systems by being able to get rid of the bricks and mortar cashier physical interface and create electronic interfaces that offer real-time story, value-based tribalism, where we're chatting with each other about our shared beliefs as a tribe, okay? And we can shop online at our time and don't have to get dressed up on Saturday and Sunday and, when we rather tool around the house with our jammies, you know, and go to farmer's market or go to whatever. And so we're now selling almost half of our product online locally with cool software that allows this chain to just run while we're sleeping. Emails get sent out. People can shop while we're sleeping and argue about, well, they say they're sold out of ribeyes, honey. Which would you rather have? We don't have to listen to that 20-minute conversation in front of our cash register. That happens in the bedroom at 12 o'clock at night. Then they punch buy, and the thing, we wake up in the morning, and the order's there. Okay? This is an amazing thing, and we're seeing now across the country more and more what I call electronic aggregation, so that we don't have to duplicate OSHA-approved, inspector-approved, people-friendly retail interfaces. We can warehouse this stuff on a farm, aggregate it together on a Zencart shopping media, platform. The farmer doesn't have to leave the farm. The customer doesn't have to leave their house. MIT has just done an amazing study showing that these systems are far less carbon footprint than even the supermarket, because everybody doesn't have to get in their car and turn left at the stoplight. Where am I? Number six, societal reverence for farmers. You all know that I am a great big advocate of the Jeffersonian intellectual agrarian, and I think that it is a blot on our culture that we have, over the last several generations, we have lost our reverence and mystique for those who preserve our air, soil, and water. And now I'm gonna get really challenging for you young farmers. I'm gonna tell you that, you know what? Society gives us only the respect that we earn. People get what they kind of deserve. And if you think you're a redneck hillbilly tobacco spitting trip over the transmission in the backyard dummy because you're a farmer, people will think of you that way. So, aspiring farmers, go get a suit. Take a bath. Get the chaff out of your hair. Join Toastmasters. Learn how to speak. Whenever anybody comes up to me and says, I want to be a farmer, what should I do? I say, join your local theater group. Learn how to tell a story. Look, if we're going to go toe-to-toe with Fortune 500 executives and go in there and stand, you got to read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Read eclectically. Read the liberal. Read the conservative. Be a person of words, a person of communication, story, culture, understanding. We're not just dumb farmers. We have the noblest vocation on earth, the oldest and noblest vocation on earth. Act like it. Don't go to farmer's market in bib overalls. Go in a three-piece suit. Ask your customers, if I show up next week driving a BMW, will you be happy or not? And if you're not happy, then you don't deserve the food I have. Are you with me? You get the dignity and the respect that you... And I am tired of having 50-year-old guys come up to me and say, I've got three siblings. I must have been the dumb one because I stayed on the farm. I hate that. And we've got to turn that around. But society isn't going to turn that around unless we make it ourselves. I don't know how many talk shows I'm on, TV and stuff, and they say, oh, where's your straw hat and your bibs? I say, those are farm clothes. When I come to town, I'm a CEO, Fortune 500 equivalent to mayors and presidents and queens and kings. And if you don't think of yourself that way and your vocation that way, you will never be thought that way by others. Okay, next.
How are we doing?
Wow. Consumer participation. All the talking in the world, ultimately, this movement is fired up. Yes, partly by innovative young farmers, but also by an awakened consumer literacy that understands it's not up to somebody else, it's up to me to begin to participate in this food system. And so that the best thing that anyone can do, whenever I, you know, do a radio program, people always ask you, what is the first thing that a person should do? You know, urban foodie program, stuff like that. The first thing anybody can do is get in their kitchen and get jazzed up about domestic culinary arts. At least as interested in culinary arts as they are in the latest dysfunction in the Kardashians. Okay, where are we here? All ingredients for good businesses do not grow on the same pair of legs. Most farmers are terrible marketers. Most farmers hate people. That's why they're farmers. I just want to be out here with my John Deere, you know. I don't want to see anybody, talk to anybody. And I sure don't want to balance the checkbook, right? So, one of the first things we need to do to be successful is to write down our strengths and weaknesses and immediately go try to find people who will complement our weaknesses. Because none of us is strong in all the gifts and talents and diversity necessary to be a successful business. That might be a marketer, it might be an accountant, it might be a finance director, it might be a salesperson, but you got to find those complementary people. Low capital entrance is necessary, okay? We've got to be able to get down to these low capital entrances. We've done a capital audit at our farm. The average farm in America, it takes $4 worth of buildings and infrastructure. Forget the land. $4 in buildings and infrastructure to turn annual gross sales of a dollar. So that's a 4-to-1 ratio. You know what our ratio is? 50 cents to a dollar. 50 cents to a dollar. Now, that's a low capital entrance, okay? And finally, we need to develop a track record. And I'm not finally, I've got some stories now. Develop a track record. You know, everybody wants it today, and that's good to want it. But you know, the book Bounce, the reality of 10,000 hours in 10 years. What we need are ways for young people who aspire to be farmers to develop a track record of trust for people who have their equity in land or equity to invest. Why should I pick you? Trust me, people with money get barraged for investment opportunities from charitable causes to everything else. Why would they invest in me? Because here's my track record. There's no reason for somebody to invest in us if we don't have a track record. So we've got to develop a track record. How do we get to that part? Okay, so I'll just tell you a little bit where we are right now. We've started 20 years ago a formal apprenticeship program, which has now morphed into an internship and apprenticeship program. And I can tell you there are lots of young people who want in. We've watched the trajectory of our applicants. Last year, we had 540 queries for 10 spots. We have watched, and it's not just us. I see it in other farms that run these programs. The fact is, you know, we are in a generation of young people now. You know, we've been through the agrarian economy, the industrial economy, the information economy. Now we're in the restorative economy. And we're in a generation now of young people that heartens me when I hear them talk about doing something noble instead of something wealthy. That's exciting. All right. Now, yeah, you can't live on nobleness. You can't go into the tax man and say, I'm noble. Here, slice off a little bit of my nobility. It'll pay my taxes. Okay. So it does take some wealth. But it's wonderful when it takes second place instead of first place. Okay. So as we have gone forward, as we've gone forward with the internship and apprentice program, we kind of view our interns as boot camp. This is boot camp, 4 months, okay? You got to come, put in your time, all right? 4 months. Anybody can do that. Then from there, you can apply to be an apprentice. That's 12 months. Then you join management, you get a nice pay, and you become a mid-manager. Then, out of either of these programs, you can ask to stay at Polyface. Here's where I want to focus the last of my few minutes with you. And that is that if we're going to grow and germinate a new generation of farmers, they need a germination bed. But all of us prosper not as an employee or an employer, but as independent, self-actualized, autonomous fiefdoms. And when we can build fiefdoms into our business, we unleash the creative entrepreneurial potential of people. And so let me just go through a couple of these with you that we have had the privilege and honor and blessing of being a part of. So we lease several farms, and rather than us running over every day and, you know, moving animals and taking care of things over there, instead, we subcontract with memorandums of understanding, MOUs, all right, with young people who want to stay. I want to run Farm A, okay? That's fine. It's available. What do you want to do? We do not say, here's what you're going to earn and here's what you're going to do. We invert that and say, how are you going to earn a living? Bring us your business plan. Bring us your idea. Okay? And so they say, well, you know, they have to go home and work it out and say, well, I need to earn this much. So how many sheep or cows or pigs or chickens or eggs or other things, honey, soap, grapevine wreaths, whatever, okay, do I need to generate this level of income, all right? And suddenly, they're in the driver's seat of determining their income. We're not saying, here's a job, who's gonna fill this job? Instead, the risk to us is that we are risking our farm's brand and future on true, vetted young people. They've got a track record now. They've been through the internship, all right? So we've worked shoulder to shoulder, side to side. The ones we don't want, obviously, you know, they don't get a crack at this. But the ones that want to stay and we like, you know, if there's mutual love and trust, then, yeah, we can work this out. And they tell us what they want to do. So our first one developed kind of very serendipitously with Nathan. He was with us as an apprentice. And he wanted to do a dairy. Well, we don't do dairy. We don't do cow share. He said, I want to start a dairy. He said, but I don't have any land. I don't have any capital. He said, could I go to one of the rental farms, move the cows every day in exchange for some acreage to start my herd share program and tap into your customer base? Because, see, we've already vetted our tribe, okay, that respects a farmer that wants to be in their kitchen, that gets all this stuff, okay? And so we said, well, sure, that sounds great. So he went over there, and he was able to leverage the sawmill that we already have, the lumber we already have, the welder we already have, and he was able to construct a portable milking parlor on an old hay wagon chassis and started his own 5-cow herd share dairy program without a single bit of capital, no indebtedness, as a full-time farmer at 18 years old. Okay? And he's now, in his whatever, fifth year, he's now outgrown that place and moved on to another, to his own arrangement. But this bought him time to develop a track record and develop trust within the community so that when an elderly farmer was going out of business, he was so enamored of what he saw Nathan doing. Yeah, come and take over my farm. He gave him 100 acres. Now he's giving him 500. Okay? And so now Nathan's gone, all right? Well, that opened it up for somebody else. And so Amanda came. Okay, so Amanda will run the farm. She ran the farm. Well, now she's, you know, getting married to a guy in Maine. All right, so now what? All right. Well, Heather wanted to stay, one of our apprentices. Heather said, well, Heather, what do you want to do? Well, last year when she was an apprentice, she wanted to brood. She wanted to hatch chicks. We started hatching chicks. What, 3 minutes? Okay. Started hatching chicks. So she went over there and began. So she now this summer has created her own business plan for us to buy the chicks that she's going to hatch. No capital, no nothing. We put the infrastructure in. She's getting paid per hatched chick, so it's a low risk. If she messes up, we don't pay anything. If she's really good, she makes a great money. And she has enough self-awareness and confidence that she's happy to do a non-guarantee thing. See, there's got to be shared risk here. It can't all be one way. I'll close with, you know, and I could go on with these stories. We've got an 18-year-old full-time horticulturalist who's taken over all the gardens as her business. In other words, we don't pay her to do the vegetables. She said, here's all I want to grow, everything I want to grow, and the price, and she bills us for the vegetables. And so it completely changes the relationship when instead of us paying her by the hour to do the vegetables, it's her business. The final one was Jonathan. He wanted to stay with us at the end of his apprenticeship. I said, well, what do you want to do? How do you want to make a living? And he said, well, I love the shop. You've never had a shop person, but, you know, the volume is so big now, maybe there's enough there. So, all right, well, bring us a proposal. He brought us a proposal. He's now our shop foreman and running one of the farms part-time. So he's part farmer and part shop foreman, developed a name for his business called Farm Fix, and we're remodeling the shop for him. I mean, we're actually pouring concrete. He's put in nice lights, and it's a Taj Mahal shop now. But he'd rather weld than eat. He's really good. For the first time in my life, I can now break a machine, bring it in, drop it at the shop, go read a book while Jonathan fixes it. That's cool. Now, I've always done the shop work because, you know, somebody has to do it, but I don't like it. Are you with me? The fact is, you think about all the things that you don't like to do, that you just really don't like to do. You know, there is somebody out there that can't wait to get up in the morning to do that very thing. And so one of the keys to success is identifying partnerships, formal and informal, where we can complement our weaknesses with others' gifts and talents. And that builds the relational complexity that creates a biomimicked person part of the ecological diversified part. And that creates stability and strength for multi-generational security. Those are just some ideas, and I just honor you and appreciate that you took the morning to come. I know you could have been anywhere but here, and I know everyone here is grateful for the attendance here and that you're focusing on these things. It is a bright time. There is incredible innovation and ideas flowing out there. And so to place ourselves in a place where we can embrace this kind of thought processes stands us in good stead as we move into the future. So now may all of your carrots grow long and straight. May your radishes be large and not pithy. May blossom end rot affect the Monsanto neighbor's tomatoes instead of yours. May all of your culinary experiments be delectably palatable. May the rain fall gently on your fields, the wind be always at your back, your children rise and call you blessed, and may we all make our nest a better place than we inherited. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for stopping off.